Welcome to Off the Hour here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We're 23 days into the month of March, and you're tuned in to Off the Hour here on CKUT 90.3 FM. CKUT's Community News Department, Long-Term Memory Radio, a program dedicated to the in-depth exploration of stories missed by the mainstream media at CKUT. Long-term memory radio aims to fill that void that exists within mass media content. Long-term memory radio is hosted by The Avalanche. First on the show today, Tom Shannon will be speaking with Mark Mattson of Lake Ontario Waterkeeper at the top of this edition of Long-Term Memory Radio. Next on the show, we are also pleased to have Dr. Michael Dworkin, President and Physician for Global Survival, with us in the CKUT studio to provide his insight on nuclear power and their news conference held this week, pardon me, on Monday, urging the shutdown of Quebec's nuclear power plant, Gentilly 2. Rana Arabi will be interviewing Dr. Dworkin. Stay tuned. You're listening to Long-Term Memory Radio, a special edition of CKUT's Community News Program Off the Hour, hosted and engineered by The Avalanche, an initiative of the West Montreal Readaptation Center. All abilities are welcome. If you'd like to get involved, call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or news at ckut.ca. It is 503. Do stay tuned. Welcome back. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. It is 505, and we now turn to Rana. Welcome, Rana.
Thank you very much. Really glad to be here today. And we are also very happy to have with us Dr. Michael Dworkin joining us in the CKUT studio this afternoon. Hi.
Thanks for inviting me, Rana.
It's really our pleasure. Dr. Michael Dworkin is a family doctor at the Herzl Family Practice Center at the Jewish General Hospital. Dr. Dworkin is also a consultant in palliative care medicine and is associate professor of family medicine at McGill University. And we've particularly invited you today on today's theme of nuclear power and energy and its grave dangers because you are president of Physicians for Global Survival, a charitable organization formed in 1980. Physicians for Global Survival is the Canadian affiliate of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, which is the only international medical organization dedicated to preventing nuclear war. So it's an interesting name. Why is it Physicians for Global Survival? I mean, it could be Physicians for Global Well-Being, but it's for survival, which means what's going on?
Well, it's an interesting question, Anna, because we've actually gone through a number of different name changes over the last 25 years. We were called Physicians for Social Responsibility as part of our American physician group. Still carries that name, but people said, well, social responsibility, what does that mean? It's not very specific to war. And then we became Canadian Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War as part of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. But then with the ending of the Cold War, it became less popular to even talk about nuclear war. And so looking at violence in general and prevention of all kinds of wars, it became a mandate of physicians to focus on survival in general. And that includes global warming and the threat of nuclear technology, pollution, environmental hazards, and so on.
Well, that's very comforting. I mean, you're really looking out for us. I mean, not only are you treating patients and helping them in their lives individually, but you're also forming these formidable associations and speaking out on important issues. Is there a reason why Physicians for Global Survival was created in 1980?
Well, this was the height of the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the Americans. there was talk of a limited nuclear war. People were at that time were very fearful of this accelerating to an actual nuclear exchange with short-range missiles in the European theater. The hostility was reaching a point where people didn't understand how dangerous a war, any kind of a missile exchange of nuclear weapons, could be disastrous. The message was there are no winners of a nuclear war, and the only way to work towards peace is by prevention. And preventing war with nuclear weapons means getting rid of the weapons altogether through an abolition movement. Now, the abolition movement started right after Hiroshima, but in the 80s, people suddenly realized just how terrifying nuclear weapons can be. We're not talking about Hiroshima weapons, which were 10 kilotons. That's 1,000 tons of TNT. We're talking about 100 megatons, orders of magnitude greater, the destructive power of hundreds and thousands of Hiroshima weapons, enough to destroy the planet. And this is what we were at stake. Our organization, in fact, looked at the medical consequences of nuclear war. Leaders such as Mayor Helen Caldicott, who was chairperson of the PSR movement in the States, organized a series of bombing runs, as we call them. We would take cities and see what it would be if a general 1 megaton bomb would land on a city, what catastrophic effects that would be. And essentially, there would be no medical response. As physicians, we couldn't respond. There would be no hospital. There would be no doctors. There would be no infrastructure, no communication. Total obliteration. And so this type of omnicide, as we call it, everything would be gone, means that there cannot be a war to be fought. And later on, this becomes even more complicated in terms of climactic changes, which I hope we can talk about later.
So you've just given us an idea of how devastating atomic bombs and nuclear war can be. And so there's still proliferation of these types of bombs today by different states.
Well, there's vertical proliferation and lateral proliferation. The vertical proliferation has actually decreased. That is, the 95% of the 20,000 or more nuclear weapons that belong to the U.S. and the USSR, now it's Russia, once the Soviet Union disappeared in 1989, Russia holds on to approximately equal number of weapons in the U.S. As I said, this is the vast majority of weapons. The other nuclear powers, Britain, France, China, Pakistan, India, and Israel, have much smaller numbers. The lateral proliferation in these other countries, which now includes North Korea and possibly Iran, are areas of greater concern. What particularly think tanks are alluding to is these kinds of major attacks are not going to happen. What people are talking mostly about are terrorist attacks with nuclear weapons, small devices that can be carried in a suitcase that can blow up a city with like a suicide bombing, essentially, but using a nuclear weapon. This could be devastating. There are measures of looking at plutonium, which is a key element in producing a bomb, that are missing from nuclear power plants in countries around the world, not accounted for. The IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, looks at these issues and monitors the presence or absence of these fissile materials, and there's fears that some of this missing material can end up in the hands of terrorists.
Sounds like an enigma. I mean, how can such materials simply disappear without, you know, officials being aware of them? But I believe we have Mark Madison on the phone, and we'll be now focusing our conversation on nuclear energy with Tom.
Okay, so as we said, we have Mark Madison, the president and co-founder of Lake Ontario Waterkeeper. He is calling in right now from the nuclear hearings in Darlington, Ontario. Hello, Mark. Mark, can you hear me?
Yeah, can you hear me, Tom?
Yes, great.
Oh, great.
Thank you. Thank you very much for joining us here on the program.
No problem.
Okay, so to start off, could you give our listeners an idea of what the Darlington Nuclear Power Plant project is, and how did you and your group get involved?
Sure. Well, I'm the president and waterkeeper for Lake Ontario Waterkeeper, and we're a charity, and I've been an environmental counsel for 22 years. So when we started the group 10 years ago, I always wanted to make sure we weren't just in sewage and water and mercury, beaches and swimmable, drinkable, fishable water. I wanted to really make sure that I stayed involved in what is one of the greatest threats and risks to Lake Ontario, which is the nuclear industry. So we've been involved in Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission hearings throughout the course of the last 10 years, and this is the biggest one. This is the first environmental assessment in Canada into a new nuclear power plant. The other ones that we've built in Canada were exempt from environmental assessment hearings. So although it's not the best environmental assessment process, Ontario exempted it from their sort of stringent rules, and it's being run by the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission and a member of the CEA panel, Canadian Environmental Assessment Act panel, and they don't have the best rules. I mean, it's not under oath or cross-examination. It's still an opportunity to get all the issues in the public and make what I consider a fairly secretive industry come out and talk about their issues. And we have some money to hire some experts, so we've had an opportunity to review their expert reports and bring our own evidence to the table. And that, you know, we've been doing that for the last 2 years, trying to get all the data and information and make sure it's available to this panel. And then, of course, what happened, it was going to be a very, I think there was only going to be about 20 people in the room until the unfortunate tragedy took place in Japan, which has brought a heightened awareness and a greater focus on this hearing, and I think really makes the point that we need really good detailed planning and improved scrutiny of our nuclear industry if we're going to even think about going ahead in the future.
Okay, so you say that this project is actually the first project to receive an environmental assessment in Canada, is that right?
New nuclear power plant, the first environmental assessment hearing for that. So there have been some proponent-driven assessments of projects in the past, or refurbishments, et cetera, and then there are licensing hearings. But yes, it's the very first time we've done an environmental assessment hearing for building a new nuclear power plant in Canada.
And when does environmental assessment usually need to be done? If this is the first, it seems strange that something so serious would be overlooked.
That's part of the problems of the past, and I think part of the industry generally is that they've always asked for special status. They are special interests, these nuclear power plant stakeholders and miners and builders. And governments passed a law that says that they needed a law even to get off the ground that protected them from damages in case of an accident. So every time you hear them going around and saying it can't happen here and how safe it is, just remember they're not prepared to put their money where their mouth is. They needed a special law to protect them from damages, and it's called the Nuclear Liability Act here in Canada, Price-Anderson in the United States. So it shouldn't be surprising that they also wouldn't want to undergo an environmental assessment hearing to have approval of a plan. I mean, that's just part of the playbook.
If I could interject, this all is based on the fact that the nuclear power originated from the nuclear bomb plan in the Manhattan Project. And so it became a secret military operation. They continue to have military connection. In the 50s, under Eisenhower, the power plant became the peaceful atom. But this was just another way of marketing this notion. But the transparency of the industry has always still been very shut. And I appreciate Mark's comments because, in fact, it's an uphill battle trying to prove that there are health consequences to nuclear power, right from uranium mining to disposal of the waste and even nuclear weapons.
Yeah, excellent point. And I think a lot of that played into Trudeau passing the Nuclear Liability Act because he passed it under peace, order, and good government as a scheme in the interest of all Canadians to prop up and perpetuate this industry. They needed this special law. And, you know, on Lake Ontario, we go back to where you're speaking, you know, the early part of making the bomb. It's in Port Hope, right? That's 1933. They first started, took a little seed plant on the harbor there on Lake Ontario and Port Hope and started the research and study. And that's where, you know, part of the fuel and the energy and the manufacturing of the fuel for the Manhattan Project came from. So, you know, Lake Ontario and this industry really has ties to Lake Ontario that make me shudder.
And what are some of the dangers that are specific to Lake Ontario that you're worried about as an organization?
There's so many. I mean, before we got into accident stuff, I mean, they all use once-through cooling, which now they'll never build a new nuclear plant in the States with once-through cooling. And once-through cooling means they just suck the water in from the lake and kick it out. Entrainment, entrapment of fish, millions of fish are killed. And then the thermal plumes destroy fish habitat. And, of course, that also is an easy place for them to, like some people we talked about last week, using their toilet to flush their garbage down. Well, the industry can use all this water as a way to get rid of their waste and dilute it with inside the plant before it really reaches their discharge point into the lake, where by then they can say, oh, well, look, you know, concentrations are so low. So it's a great way for them to play down the numbers, but the loadings are the same into the lake. So we're complaining about that. We're also concerned about, you know, this is drinking water for 7 million people. Lake Ontario is only 1% renewable, so, you know, this is it for us. And we're privileged to have this great body of fresh water, but we can't screw with it, and if we do, you know, there really is an alternative a lot to the communities on the Great Lakes. They've sort of destroyed most of their groundwater supplies, and we'd have to build pipelines a long way away to restore clean water here. I think, you know, these are really dense communities, they're built up, Pickering, Darlington, many reactors, adding a few more beside the Darlington and Pickering plant. So when you're talking about a one in, let's say, 600-year Richter scale 6 earthquake, which they build them to, well, you know, for every reactor, if that did ever occur, one in 600 years, I mean, I know those odds seem very high, and then for something to go wrong, but, you know, I also know these guys like to say they're perfect, they're not, and one in 600 years means, you know, what does that make it, a 5% chance in the next 25 years, and then you've got all these reactors, so it's not just, if it did happen, we wouldn't just have problems with one reactor, we've got 8 at Pickering, 4 at Darlington, 2 more. Add them all up, and each one of them, you know, in terms of these odds, they start getting to the point where you're going, geez, the San Francisco Giants were 250 to 1 to win the World Series last year, and everybody around me are you know, going out million to one of these lotteries. I get nervous when it's talking about consequences of, you know, that could wipe us off this area of Lake Ontario. So I hate that shadow. I don't like it. It's not necessary. I think there's lots of bridging fuels to move forward to a distributed energy system. I think there's lots of technology that allows us to be creative, and if we put the same amount of attention and money and time into building a, you know, really a new, modern, and green, and renewable, and sustainable energy, we have the resources in Canada, and we can do it. And I hate to see us waste all this time and attention on something that really just, seems to paint a shadow over all of us, and it doesn't really focus on the great things about the lake. It really just makes it almost seem dangerous.
I can't agree with Mark more, because the industry continues to feel that pouring things like tritium into the water is safe because of the vastness of the lake. But we in the environmental movement know there's no solution for pollution by dilution. In other words, no matter how you try to keep the toxins away, ultimately they'll get into the biosphere. And that's only the water that we're measuring, the effluent that goes into the air that ultimately gets absorbed into the biosphere through the grass and the cows and the milk and the pregnant women who are lactating and giving them to their babies, and even the fetus in the womb of the pregnant ladies are at highest risk of this. In fact, there have been at least 4 major studies showing that there's an increased incidence of infantile leukemia in children living around nuclear power plants. The industry says impossible, the levels are too low, they can't be. And yet in these studies, the farther away these children are measured, the lower the risks, the incidence of the leukemia occurs. Those who live within 5 kilometers, highest incidence, 10 kilometers less, and so on, as you move away from the nuclear power plant. Again, using these assumed levels of safety, it's almost reaches a ridiculous commentary, because Canada's level, for example, for tritium is 10 times higher than the U.S., which is another five times higher than the Europeans. They choose to do that because CANDU, in fact, has the highest production of tritium. And that's only one of the isotopes we were talking about, in particular because our Ontario colleagues have, in fact, just recently had a whole hearing about looking at the tritium levels in the water and trying to create a greater consciousness of the potential threat to health of the higher doses of tritium in Lake Ontario and abouts.
And that council, by the way, I participated in that, and their recommendations came out in May 2009. They're excellent. I mean, they and the industry participated in those hearings, and they set, you know, you're right, 7,000 becquerels per liter for drinking water right now in Canada. I think there's 700 in the States, but in some jurisdictions, California, they get down to 20. And the recommendations from the Ontario Drinking Water Advisory Council, made up of all kinds of stakeholders, it wasn't just, you know, public citizens, it was industry too, recommended 100, which is what? I forget how many times less than 7,000, right now, and in 5 years, 20 becquerels per liter, which I think is 350 times less. So, you know, it's regardless of what the industry says, every time we look at this stuff and pull the documents out and look at the science, you know, it becomes very clear that, you know, there are all these issues and problems and concerns and things that we would never allow anyone else to do, and somehow they get away with it. And this new nuclear Darlington plant, I was cross-examining this morning, and the 2009 Ontario Drinking Water Advisory Council report has not been considered or incorporated into the new standards for discharge from this plant, which they want to license for the next 90 years. So, you know, it's tough. And, you know, the science is pretty clear, and, you know, and I know as a criminal, you know, I was a lawyer as well, it's really hard to prove that something killed you, you know, so it's hard for people, it's easy to look at the probabilities and say that 10% of the population gets sick or something, but I don't know if you've noticed it happened in Quebec, up in, I think it was Gage, what's that place with the TC in the water? Gagetown.
Mm-hmm.
Supreme Court Canada now, you know, the government's there saying you can't prove that killed you.
Well, this is always the problem with any toxic exposures. Yeah. There's no label attached to the toxin, and there's a latency period anywhere between 5 years for leukemia to 20 years for solid cancers.
Mm-hmm. So and they want you to prove beyond a balance of probability.
Exactly.
You know, they're not doing their job as a public interest organization in getting out there and protecting us any longer, some call it precautionary principle, or even doing these proper health studies instead of risk assessments. I mean, they're actually out there now using the law to defend themselves from liability. It's just, you know, whether it's in the Athabasca Basin, nuclear stuff in Port Hope or Gagetown, it's the wrong approach, and it just really makes me, really disappoints me.
In terms of our listeners who are living in Montreal, you must remember that although Darlington seems far away, we have Gentilly too in Three Rivers, not too far from Montreal, and it happens to be on a earthquake fault line, so don't feel reassured that we have a safety environment in our own backyard. In fact, this is one of the reasons we have regrouped over 20 environmental and nuclear activist organizations within the Quebec region. We had a press conference on Monday to speak out on the refueling and retooling refurbishment, as it's called, of Gentilly, which we're trying to stop for these very reasons. They're dangerous precedent. It's never been done. It's going to cost us as taxpayers $1.9 billion if it ever can be done. The people in New Brunswick, Pointe-le-Preux, still haven't been able to refurbish their power plant. And for those people who don't know the longevity of a power plant, they don't actually run longer than 30, 35 years. Then they become too radioactive and need to be shut off or rebuilt, essentially, at enormous costs and with technology that we're not even sure is safe.
Congratulations on that, too. We heard about that, and I heard one of your parties are supporting your call to close down Gentilly. So, good. That was great.
We're in solidarity.
Yeah, we heard about it at the hearing, believe it or not.
That's great.
Yeah, so...
Well, if I may interject here, mm-hmm. What I was wondering about, And I think that the listeners, certainly the Canadian listeners, are wondering, why is it that we have such higher chemical tritium in our waters versus the Europeans, who are full of nuclear power plants, as we see all over the place in France and possibly other European nations? Is it regulation is what I'm asking?
No, it's because the CANDU is a heavy water reactor, which is unique to the CANDU design. It's the only one of its kind, and it's felt by the Atomic Energy Limited. ACL feels that this design is a safer design for numerous reasons, which are technologically challenging, but they can convince you of anything. The ultimate, for our sense and purposes in terms of tritium, because of this heavy water, the effluent coming from the nuclear power plant, whether it's being in the cooling water, being thrown back into Lake Ontario or the St. Lawrence in terms of Gentilly, or being discharged as steam from the regular operation of the nuclear power plant, there is where we have highest levels of tritium as just one factor in the potential toxic effects of radioisotopes that come out of a nuclear power in regular usage. We're not talking about accidents. Now, if there is an incident where you have to let off more steam, then you're letting off more isotopes, which potentially increase the concentration and potential threat to the community that lives around. People say that, pregnant women shouldn't be living within 10 kilometers of a nuclear power plant for the reasons we previously mentioned, as an example. Radioiodine should be available to everybody living within 20 kilometers of a nuclear power plant. So the kind of situations that's happening in Fukushima will not happen here in Canada.
Right. I do want to ask specifically to Ontario, too. Do you know, Mark, how much power that the Darlington power plant would actually provide?
The new one?
Yes. If they were to build it, how much?
If they get all four, I think it's another 3,000 megawatts.
Okay.
In that range. I think they haven't decided on the reactor yet. They've got these four potential ones. They're sort of playing a shell game, I think, to try and figure out who's going to pay for it and who's going to give them the best deal. So they want to go with the assessment without identifying it. But they threw CANDU 6 back in there. I think that's 600 watts, megawatts. And then they got this AECL 1000. I think that explains itself, 1,000 megawatts. And then there's a Westinghouse one in there and an Areva. So depending on what they choose, you know, it's in that range. And when you add it, you know, the government of Ontario says they've committed to maintaining 50% of their electricity source or supply coming from nuclear power. So, you know, Ontario basically committing to this industry like no one. It's unbelievable. It's like no other. And, you know, they're throwing all their eggs in that basket. And it seems rather odd at this time, particularly with 20 years ago when we did the demand supply plan here, and the reason for building the nuclear power plants was because natural gas prices were going to go through the roof and no one could afford to pay them. Clearly, that didn't happen, and they're at all-time lows. The gas comes in pipelines. I know it's a fossil fuel, but it is a good bridging fuel to move to a new, distributed energy. And, you know, there are no ashes left over, and you don't have to truck it. People forget about uranium. They say no greenhouse gases. I mean, I don't know if you ever see these mines. Then they got to dig it up, and then they got to move it, and then they got to make it, which they do down, you know, Blind River, or then down to Port Hope, where I see they're burning coal all the time. And then they got to move it again, ship it to the reactors, whether they're in Japan or South Korea or wherever, and then because Westinghouse is in or General Electric has a plant in Peterborough, but they ship it and they burn it, and then they got to keep it cool for who knows how long. And if you're Bruce Nuclear Power, it's even more. Then you stick it on these old ships that burn bunker sea oil and send it over to Sweden and then ship it back. So there's a lot of fuel being moved around the uranium fuel cycle, and they never include that. And, you know, so I'm not making the case that, you know, natural gas is going to save us or it's the best, but maybe we, you know, do some other things to offset our footprint but use natural gas as a bridging fuel. I know there's the gas frackings now coming in as well that's really causing concerns about groundwater supplies, especially in Pennsylvania, New York, and in Quebec. I know you guys are dealing with these issues, right. And those are really serious too. So, You know, there is some cleaner areas, and you know, and there are some worse areas. And but whatever we do, you know, I think Ontario has to just. I think if we just could free ourselves from nuclear power, I think we'd be creative. We've got billions, you know, $11 billion in revenue and electricity. It's a huge province. We could lead the way. And there's all kinds of renewable stuff we know, you know, from the wind and the solar, and but also this distributed power and combined heat and power. I think it holds a lot of promise in turning homes into little power units. And the current gas use can be somehow used to produce electricity, and maybe the homeowner can even benefit. But you need a good grid. You have to keep track of who's buying and who's selling so the checks know where they're going. To his house, and it's going to be a huge redistribution of money. I mean, it's going to go from one industry and one central oligopoly from getting these billions of dollars to being spread out among, you know, everyone. And I think that's the big concern. And plus, Ontario's worried about spending all that money they get from their ratepayers and sending it part of it to Quebec or part of it to Alberta. It's like, oh, we're Ontarians. We need our own electricity industry. And I find that odd too. That you know, Canada doesn't have a national energy policy that reflects and is in the public interest of all Canadians, and that we're all out there sort of trying to build our own empires. That always sort of made me wonder, because I do travel the country a lot, and it just seems wrong. But anyways, so I don't see a big deal about getting off nuclear power if we got off it now. I think we could do it. I think it would be exciting. I think it would be renewing. I think it would be energizing, and I think we'd be leaders.
I can't agree with you more. Again, I just want to raise two points. One is that the Chantilly plant in Quebec only gives us 3% of our energy grid. We are so rich in hydroelectric in Quebec that we sell it to the Americans. Heaven forbid we should sell it to the Ontarian people because they don't want anything from Quebec. I mean, I'm being a bit cynical, but I hear you. A national energy policy where we could share our resources in ways that it's a win-win situation and ultimately cost-effective. You did mention Bruce, and of course I had to bring up the issue of the steam generators and the transportation issue through the Great Lakes. This is a very hot topic that the listener should be aware of, because if it, as it appears to be, comes through, these highly radioactive, huge steam generators are being shipped through Lake Ontario, up St. Lawrence, past Montreal, to Sweden, where the steel will be melted down and sold, and the highly radioactive materials will be sent back to Bruce, where who knows what to do with that, because nobody knows what to do with the highly radioactive waste, although the industry still will convince us all that they have a solution. Well, after all these years, no solution is at hand. But more importantly, there's a moral imperative here where we're profiteering from sending radioactive steel to be used, who knows, in third world countries, with people maybe not even knowing that they're receiving this kind of potentially unhealthy, to say the least, radioactive metal. And the concerns about an accident along the way, they wouldn't have an oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. They said they wouldn't have any kind of nuclear power accident in the highly technological and advanced Japanese communities. The accidents happen. By definition, they're potential and should be avoided. And having these steam generators have catastrophic spill in our waterways could be devastating forever. We're talking about isotopes that live for thousands and thousands of years.
And can I just add one interesting point to that? I don't know if it's just tangential, but, you know, it is interesting to me, too, that Bruce is our first sort of big privatized nuclear power plant. You guys know that we sold it. And that's what's allowing them to ship this to Sweden, because there's a treaty that prevents OPG from sending, you know, exporting nuclear waste or whatever from these plants anywhere. So they can't export it. So it's funny, I get a lot of support from the Ontario Power Generation people. They're not all happy that Bruce is doing this, but Bruce is exempt because it's private and it's not bound by those treaties. And I find that outrageous. And that, you know, Canada has this, you know, a good national policy that we don't do this. We don't want it going over there and being recycled and getting into the bloody, you know, other people's products. And yet the CNC approves it. How can that be? I'm still boggled by that. I brought that up at the hearing, but as you guys know, those hearing processes, we get 10 minutes, no cross-examination. And basically, I get almost thrown out at the end every time because my 10 minutes is up. But I'm still boggled by that, that Canadians would allow it to happen and that the regulator would allow it to happen just because of a loophole.
Okay, well,
privatized it, so.
Thank you, Mark. We're just going to take a quick musical break, if that's okay with you.
And, yeah, is it good music?
It's going to be the best. We'll be back in very shortly.
Okay.
Okay, bye.